Welcome back to WordBalloon.com, the pop culture conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, a great talk with writer Matt Fraction. This month alone, Matt has two debut books, Punisher War Journal, which ties directly into Civil War, and The Immortal Iron Fist, co-written with Ed Brubaker. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about both of those books, but we're also going to discuss Five Fists of Science, a book that came out in 2006, featuring Matt's take on Mark Twain, Nikola Tesla, Thomas Edison, and a host of other historical figures from the end of the 19th century. We'll also discuss Last of the Independents, a great crime book Matt wrote a few years back, featuring wonderful art by Kiernan Dwyer. And for you fans of pop culture, I think I've found my match when it comes to the mind of Matt Fraction. By the end of this conversation, if you're still in school, we're going to give you at least five essay subjects that would make for interesting conversation. Let's start things off with a conversation about Casanova, Matt's wigged out spy series from Image Comics. Let's start with Casanova.
All right, Casanova.
I love the text stuff in the back and
thank you, sir.
Enjoying the story, and I congratulate you. I think Hunter S. Thompson would love this book.
Wow, that's awesome. Thank you. Somebody described it as so-and-so as like James Bond on Angel Dust, which I like because I think describing something as blah-blah on acid is a little cliche. You know, I'm a little over it. And, like, to go to Angel Dust like that, because it's another thing to say, like, it's on speed or Angel Dust. Like, that guy's done Angel Dust.
He knows
if
the
somebody compares something to being, like, you don't, that's just not a reference you go to unless you have firsthand experience. So, it's the number one comic amongst dust fiends.
Congratulations, man.
Yeah, we're going to put that in the Entertainment Weekly review on the front cover for number five. It's going to be very exciting.
So there are obvious nods to Bond, and as you even acknowledge yourself, S.H.I.E.L.D. and Diabolique.
Sure.
And it's a lot of fun. And also, I totally got what you were saying in the text piece of issue one with the comparison to Phil Spector and the Wall of Sound. Because, you know, and it's funny because there's a thread, I think there's a thread through all of your books where there are, you know, references and to other forms of pop culture that have obviously influenced your form of storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not the kind of thing you can hide, you know what I mean? I mean, even starting with Mantooth is such a, I mean, Casanova is for Mantooth without the jokes, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
Independence is a Don Siegel. You know, it's very clearly inspired by Charlie Varrick and sort of a riff on. Yeah, no, I mean, I just you can't change who your family is. You can't change your DNA. You can't change where you came from. So like, embrace it. Like, better than somebody come to you and fuck yeah, I love Jerry Cornelius, love James Bond. Like, yes. You know, George Lazenby was the best James Bond, and I will fight any man that says it differently.
Well, I'll give you on Her Majesty's Secret Service is the best Bond film.
It's so incredible. Oh, my God. I'm going to go watch that movie right now. is it okay if I'm swearing an awful lot?
Yeah, so absolutely. This is the internet, man. You can say whatever the hell you want.
I just didn't know, like, if you had a kind of flavor of show you preferred to run over any other. So. You can't hide your roots, so celebrate them, embrace them, steal from the best, by God.
So is Lazenby kind of, your model for Casanova then, or?
I think he's a little too old. Even though he was like 22 or whatever when they made that movie, in my mind, it's just he's such a majestic, this week, have you seen the new Entertainment Weekly?
No, I haven't.
The one that Casanova's reviewed in?
Please.
Daniel Craig is on the cover with Bond, but they've made up covers, like period covers, for each of the Bonds. So, like they've presupposed this is what Entertainment Weekly would look like in 1969 when George Lazenby took over the role. And there's, like a little subheadline, like, Leslie Gore's Secret Heartache. And, I mean, it's just it's really awesome. I don't know whose idea it was, but somebody at EW needs a raise because it's just perfectly executed, and the design sensibility is really great. But is Lazenby... No, I don't know. Somebody asked me the other day, who would you cast? No idea. I don't think there is a template, a little bit of everybody.
And Casanova's a little crustier, I think, than the polished look of Lazenby in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, but I had always heard that after the film, he really, in fact, I remember seeing it in the documentary, he was talking about how, film at the time was exploding with Easy Rider and stuff, and James Bond was old hat, and I almost wonder if kind of the way that Casanova kind of is kind of grunged up, and certainly even in issue three,
you know, that maybe that was just like, you know, Lazenby post Bond in terms of kind of finding himself, and the rumors of him trying to work with Bruce Lee on something.
Oh, God, like in heaven, that movie exists. You know what I mean? Like when you die, like St. Peter, like opens up the gates and like, okay, now you can watch either Bruce Lee's A Game of Death or the Bruce Lee George Lazenby movie, whichever. They only have two movies in heaven. They both started Bruce Lee. It's pretty fucking sweet.
I'm sure that's in the alternate universe that Casanova now finds himself in.
Yeah, that's one of the things too. Like, there's all this stuff, and I always keep. I don't know, maybe as I get into it a little bit more and get a little bit better at writing the book, I can start squeezing. There are all these rules, like, in the Casanova universe, like, only I know about, like there are iPods, but only Revolver and Rubber Soul is, like, the latest Beatles album. So, like, Sgt. Pepper's hasn't come out yet. Like, it's just kind of full of dumb crap like that. But then also in the Casanova verse, it was Paul that was assassinated.
Okay.
and everybody is embarrassed at what became of John Lennon. Like, oh God, what an old, annoying hippie he became.
Oh man, so the promise of double fantasy didn't lead to better things.
No, it did not. No, but I just figured that it doesn't matter who got shot first. The other guy would be blamed for destroying the Beatles anyway.
I see. Okay.
So that's just my theory.
I got it. Okay.
Anyway, you know.
Now you got this really edgy, and I'll call it edgy, thing between, you know, Casanova's alternate universe sister, and I think it's hilarious. Anybody blanch over at Image? Larson is cool with it? All the guys? You're like, hey, man, it's your book. Do whatever the hell you want?
As far as I know, I haven't really asked.
Okay.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, when you're a kid, and, like, if you ask mom, she might say no. So if you go ahead and do it, maybe you'll get in trouble later. But this way, I'm not, you know.
Okay.
It is a lot of people, you know, at the end of the second issue, Cass shoots her.
Right.
And a lot of people were like, not a lot, but I heard from a few people later that, like, well, I can't believe he killed her. I'm like, well, he didn't kill her. He shot her in the gut. And look, she's kind of, like, breathing there at the end. Like, she's, you know, has the ellipses. So, I mean, she's, you know, to me, it's sort of like the equivalent of, you know, how, like, with brothers and sisters, like, pull pigtails and, you know, stop touching me, that kind of thing. Like, this is how the Quinn family shoot each other for dead on South American rooftops. Yeah, it's all fun and games, man.
Well, it's a family of spies, so I guess that makes sense.
Exactly. So, it's a fine line that we walk. I don't know. It's always my suspicion as to why I don't think human cloning will ever be legal. Because I think inevitably there would be people who would like clone themselves just to have sex with themselves. It's not gay. It's like masturbation. What?
It's the highest form of narcissism. Exactly.
Exactly. And I was thinking about that. Like, well, wait a minute. Are they actually still related? Because they're not. Well.
Right. No, and that's the thing. You've got that, you know, that's her certainly line of thinking and everything. So it's certainly fine in her book.
Yeah, it gets even, and it's even more twisted in three. So, I knew I was pushing a button when, like Sean Conan, our letterer, would call me and be like, dude, what the fuck? What the fuck are you? This is so twisted. Like, okay, well. Apparently I'm an only child, so I only imagine what it's like to have a
There you go.
I couldn't get it out without laughing. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I think people appreciate the laughing to know where you're coming from. That's great.
Yeah, exactly. Thank God. Yeah, exactly.
There's
no way that can appear out of context on the internet now.
No, you know, but it's funny. When I talked to Jimmy Palmiotti about The Pro as well, I think sexuality in comics, it's okay in the independent books, the really hard-edge independent books, but anything that comes close to the mainstream, you know, you're walking a fine line sometimes, depending on who gets their hands on the book.
I think that's sort of, yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's, I just think that's the nature of, you know, American media, you know?
Yes.
I mean, look at how you show violence is far more acceptable to us than sex.
Yep.
And it makes sense. The mainstream of comics would be exactly like the mainstream of, was it Jeff Johns that wrote the sex scene in Avengers that got all the trouble?
Chuck Austin, I think.
That was Chuck Austin.
With Ant-Man and the Wasp, when he was between her breasts.
Yeah, between her legs originally.
Oh, that's right.
that was Chuck Austin?
Yep.
You know, that caused, and that was sort of like, that wasn't even, that was just sort of...
Implied.
Yeah, but, you know, I guess, God forbid, people do it. I don't know.
Well, now, and then the other side of Casanova, which I think is cool, is the narration. And it is kind of this stream of consciousness narration.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm, if we can dovetail into the War Journal, the Punisher War Journal that's coming up, I'm wondering if that's going to inform Frank Castle's War Journal narration as well.
It's a very different style, obviously.
Okay.
I mean, Cass is consciously breaking the fourth wall. The characters are aware that they're being observed and address the reader directly. But with War Journal, it's much more traditional sort of narration stuff.
Okay,
And much less sort of self-aware of the device. If that makes sense. It's kind of hard to say without sort of like actually like reading.
No, I understand.
Yeah, but I mean, it is. I mean, that's Frank is great. Like his like thought process is hilarious. You know, he's it's like one of the funnest characters in the world to write, just because funnest. You can tell I'm a writer. it's just you know what I mean. So it's you're robbing yourself of some of the experience if you don't give yourself a couple of thought balloons here and there from Frank, I think anyway. But it's a very careful, very deliberate line to walk. I think that it's pretty clear that I'm the one writing War Journal when you read it. But like I said, it's a different animal.
So does he think the superheroes are ridiculous and a nuisance, or does he just find them funny and just kind of an a temporary obstacle until he his guns come out and he blows them out of the way?
Well, he would never. I mean, he would never kill somebody on his side. You know, he would never kill. He's never killed a cop. He's never killed SHIELD agents. You know what I mean? He's not that guy. But it's sort of Civil War. It's the events that happen in Connecticut are what bring him sort of back to the surface.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's not so much. It's that supervillains have obviously upped their game to the point where they can destroy, Stamford. And at the same time, in response, it seems to him that the superheroes fight each other. And so Frank's concern is like somebody, I've not really been writing the character like a guy trying to avenge, the death of his wife and kids. I mean, obviously, I think he mourns them and he's lost, he feels their loss every day, but he's like embraced that and he's no longer like just killing Goombas, trying to make that hurt go away.
Sure.
Like, I think he's sort of healed, And now this is just what he does. Like, I think Frank is the healthiest guy he knows.
Right. He's efficient.
And this is like, it's totally like, this is just what I do. I go out and I stop more me's from happening. I think that's what his kind of call to action is. Somebody has to protect people, and the superheroes aren't doing it. And God help you if Frank Castle thinks you need his help.
This is being recorded the day after the Civil War delay announcements were made. Does that affect War Journal at all?
Yeah. No, we come out after one is tied into War Journal 5. So as soon as War Journal 5 comes out, we're done. I'm cooking on issue 5 already of War Journal.
Okay. So Civil War 5 has to come out before War Journal 1 comes out.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then 6 and 2, and after that we're kind of, we have a little bit with 3, but we're okay.
Okay.
But no, I mean, for the most part, the landmarks are there, and we're just kind of, trying to stay away and do our thing and make it a satisfying read. And God, I hate, weak-ass tie-ins,
Yes.
So we're doing everything we can to, make them, satisfying stories, as issues, and then as kind of this Civil War arc has a kind of point and a thrust to it, and the book has a very clear mission statement that we're, expressing. And all. So it's we got enough to worry about before trying to,
jump into a story. Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I was wondering, because, it's tough to start a new book when this big event is happening, and it is tied to that event.
But it's weird, but I mean, at the same time, it's like, it's very clear when he's on stage and when he's off stage, so to speak. So it's kind of, it's like, I use the expression that it's like writing by algebra.
Okay.
It's like 4 plus x equals 5, and we have to now figure out what x is.
Okay.
So we have 4 and we have 5, and we know there's an x, we gotta get there. So it's this kind of, it's a really weird, it's all part of the adventure, it's kind of why I signed up to do it and why I really wanted to do it, was it's just such a bizarre. Who'd have thought, jerk-ass prick from the internet here would, you know, ever ever be having the conversations that I've been having. So,
well, who approached you, and how did you get the assignment?
I was approached by Axel Alonso.
Okay.
I was picked by Axel Alonso. He sort of came to me and was like, "Hey, you're my guy. You should do this. Do you want to do it?" And we started to talk about it. And I was like, "Fuck yeah, I do. I want to do it." So
that's cool.
It was it was like no pressure, you know. Oh, hey, I'm Axel Alonso. We're going to relaunch Punisher. You're the guy. I never talked to anybody else, so don't fuck it up. But I don't think you will. Bye. No pressure. No pressure.
He has a great eye for talent, and I like his choices in terms of the guys that he's brought into Marvel. So.
Yeah, well, thank you, sir. And you're I wanted, like, my first real editor experience, you know, you could do a lot worse.
You bet.
To work with Axel freaking Alonso, you know. And that was a huge reason why, that was another big reason why I took the job. Like, I wanted to work with Axel. I wanted to know what that was like, what that relationship was like, you know.
So that's cool. Have you gotten any, you know, pats on the back from any of the other Marvel folk? I know Brubaker, obviously, and I want to talk about Iron Fist.
I don't know that anyone has actually seen any of this stuff yet. So,
okay.
The biggest bad pat has been from, you know, Brubaker. Miller said some very kind things. He kind of knows where we're going in the grand scheme of things.
Okay.
And he said some nice stuff. But yeah, I mean, for the most part, you know, Ed and I were sort of friendly before this, but I know Casanova actually really kind of went over on the Iron Fist thing, and that was what made him think about talking to me about Iron Fist.
That's cool. You guys are co-plotting, and you're going to do the scripting.
Yeah.
And I asked Ed about Iron Fist because... I'm curious to hear what your feelings are about Danny Rand as a character. It seems to me that he's the kind of character that would appeal to you because he's part 70s Kung Fu and part Lost Horizon.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's like the scion of like 9 different pulp lineages. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
His story is just... Like, why the fuck isn't there an Iron Fist book, like, today? Like, why isn't Iron Fist 598 coming out tomorrow? he's a billionaire and, like a mystical kung fu warrior. Dude, it's such an awesome book. It's just everything you need. It's just everything about the character just reeks of cool. I think he's such a great, like, such a weird kind of... his perspective is awesome to me, like that's sort of like his life arc and sort of where he is and what he does and everything else, and the whole Ed handled him excellently in Daredevil, and you know, it's great. I can't wait to I'm having a blast with it so far.
It's been a long time since the guy has really shined on his own.
Yeah, well, and the green capri pants and yellow booties didn't help.
That's what Ed said.
You know, the capri pants and booties, not an awesome combination. The Freddie Mercury stripper collar down to his navel, also not helping him much. So there was some wardrobe malfunction along the way. I just think it's people trying to get all into like the moon stuff or this, that, and the other. It's like, dude, it's the story's right there. You know, it's his character is right there, and like all Ed and I are doing is really just sort of like. No, see, you got them all twisted around. You got to straighten them out here. You know, it's like you're sort of, you know, combing his hair and straightening his tie and kind of presenting it. It's like, we're not really, like, adding anything. We're just reminding people, like, no, see, but if you put the light here and he's shining the light on this cool thing, he's that cool thing, and suddenly you have the fucking, you know, Chinese pirate Iron Fist killing 3,000 guys, and then how does that relate to Danny today in New York? I'm like, oh, well, there's a story, you know?
Sure. Did you, you must have obviously loved the Essential collection that came out last year.
Yeah, I mean, that and the Power Man one, I think, are really two of the actual essential comics.
I'm a big fan of the Power Man one, too. I just think it's hilarious seeing what passed for, you know...
Comics?
Well, not like comics, but also just, like, can't, you know, just sanitized jive.
Yeah, and oh, just, yeah, yeah, no.
A lot of the choices they made to substitute swearing.
Yeah, it's a sweet Christmas indeed. I think they really had their ear to the street there at Marvel in the 70s. It's awesome. It's so great. Like, what passed for comics back then? It's hilarious and excellent. And, like, and I'm just, I mean, it's obviously there's a degree of ironic enjoyment.
Yes.
But there's something very sincere about that energy and that mania, you know, that just, like, foaming, frothing, rabid, I have to fucking write 22 comics this month. You know what I mean? They become like these, like, they're like dream journals, you know? Like, what? You did what? It's just, it's like, you know, like there's two different steel serpents in Iron Fist.
That's right.
Because apparently somebody, like, the name is so awesome, I have to bring it back. I shouldn't have killed that guy because the name is too cool. Fuck. Well, this is the other steel serpent. Like, who, what kind of, what? And you know that editorial decision was reached because I believe it was Tony Isabella said to his editor, whom I want to say was Archie Goodwin, yeah, but the name is really cool. And that was the end of the conversation.
And the green light was given.
Now I totally want to pull out like the essential and make sure that I got that reference right, but I'm almost positive that's who those guys were.
Well, and that generation of Marvel writers I thought was really neat, and you know, I'd throw Steve Englehart in there
Englehart,
as well.
Absolutely,
and
absolutely.
Like they were all these guys that were just coming out of college and being in college in the late '60s. That yeah. You know, the inmates were taking over the asylum.
Yes, they were cosmically aware, so to speak.
Absolutely, and they really kind of. They grew up on the original, you know, Stan and Jack runs and Steve Ditko and stuff like that.
But they were different than the Roy Thomas era of like that first wave. They were like this, like it was like wave like 1.5. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like Roy Thomas and those guys were like the direct, immediate sort of fan press guys. But then like Englehart, they were the first ones who were really sort of filtered down to like it was received culture to them. You know?
I agree.
At that point. It's like, I don't know, maybe these guys were reading it from number one, but it was a thing that sort of existed kind of before them. You know, they're the first, like, legacy writers to come in. And,
yes.
Yeah, it's an amazing period for Marvel. And just, like, and so experimental. And, like, the Deadly Hands of Kung Fu, like, the magazine.
Yes.
Where there was, like, editorial content. Like, here's 9 ways to kick a guy. And then there's, like, a 4-page, you know, Iron Fist story.
Yep.
Somebody approved that. Somebody fucking said, you know what? We're going to spend money on this shit because that's fucking dope.
Well,
4 pages of Iron Fist and then an article about how to kick a guy? Gold. Green light. Go.
Is Brubaker going to let you write anything for Criminal? Because essentially that's what I was asking Ed about Criminal in terms of because he's going to have text pieces in the book. And I said, wow, is it going to be like, you know, the crime, you know, equivalent of Deadly Hands of Kung Fu?
I'm going to write the articles about how to kick guys.
yeah, how to pick a pocket.
Yeah, exactly. Here's the discussion with Ed kind of brought it up. I was like, oh, I would love to write a thing about, he was like, you know, you could write, you know, about a film, you know, a film noir that you love.
Right.
And I was like, oh, dude, I would love to write an article about I Am a Fugitive from the Chain Gang.
The classic.
This is 1933, Mervyn LeRoy, you know.
Yes, sir.
Classic. Some of which takes place in Chicago.
Was that a Paul Muni?
It is a Paul Mooney film. Yeah.
See?
I actually got to see that at the Art Institute in Chicago.
Oh, that's cool.
And they showed a print of all things. And there's a shot of the Art Institute in the film.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't remember that. That's really neat.
There's a very weird, like, time warp thing that happens when you're looking at a shot of a building that you're watching the movie in, you know, like 50 years ago. It's like you can't wait for Marty McFly to go running by and take your sporting book. But no, so I said, oh, I could write a thing about I'm a Fugitive from the Chain Gang. And there's this, like, long pause. And Ed goes, are you sure? So, you know, I think we'll get there. But
well, I want you to explore something. We had a conversation briefly in San Diego about movies like Walter Matthau's movies of the 70s, Varick and
Tinkin. In the 70s, everybody got to kick ass and sleep with really hot women. The older, whiter, and fatter you were, the better.
But they were cool movies. And they're, you know, the least likely action heroes. And you had a perfect example, and I told you I'm still looking for a print of Alex and the Gypsy.
Alex and the Gypsy.
And that's Jack Lemmon.
That's Jack Lemmon as a bondsman.
Yeah.
Which of course, and he's got a mustache. Oh, dude, it's so awesome.
Looking really seedy, yeah.
Yeah, like anybody hearing my voice right now, just pull open the browser window, go to images.google.com, and look up Alex and the Gypsy, and just let that picture of Lemon with that stash and the shoulder holster just wash over you. Just bask in it, like respect it, you know, and just because that was the 70s. Somebody's like, Jack Lemmon kills a guy. Fucking green light that shit. That's a fucking movie. And St. Pulver does what?
Well, even worse, you know, think of the generation. Grumpy old, you know, the guy from Grumpy Old Men as the Bales Bondman getting some serious ass and then shooting a gun and stuff. It just doesn't make sense. But, yeah, you're right, that was the 70s. And that's why I liked Last of the Independents so much. Now, it seems like you were saying that that had more in, you know, connection with things like The Getaway.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and it reminded me, really, if you put Lee Marvin in The Getaway, I think, you know, that kind of came close to what you got in Last of the Independents.
Yeah, yeah, thank you. That's
Oh, dude, that's truly the first book of yours I read. And you and Kiernan Dwyer, and it was just fantastic. And I loved that it was on that tan-colored paper. Is it sepia?
Yeah, man, Kieran's just a fucking genius. It just was perfect. Man, he just made me look way smarter and way better than I actually am. I still to this day, like, I have like 4 or 5 pages from it, and you know, I can look at his work in that book for hours. And like, he got like the physicality, like it's a book about an old man, you know, and like,
yes,
hearing the physicality, it didn't look like a young man with wrinkles. He looked like an old dude, you know, like just, you could feel that kind of crusty, broke down soul, and just so great.
Yeah. One Last Score. And,
yeah,
and you know, crusty old dude that's got the hot chick.
Yeah.
And the sweet but simple muscle and everything. And that was another great thing, just as they were planning their last, you know, big job and everything, what was going through their minds the night before, you know, their last move or whatever.
Yeah.
And just cutting to the big guy, and all he can think about is playing with puppies.
Yeah, you know, sometimes puppies. It needed to let a little bit of joke, you know, just needed a little bit of tension release right there. Because, yeah, puppies. That's one of my favorite drawings.
It was great, man. That's a really fun book, and that is really one book that I always recommend to people who haven't read your stuff yet. It's like, oh god, you got to see Last of the Independents. It's tremendous.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. And Five Fists of Science was a lot of fun as well.
I had a thing about writing books about old dudes.
Well, and also, you know, I was growing up in, you know, when I was in grade school, I was one of those people that were kind of taken in by the whole idea of Thomas Edison being this wonderful man who brought light literally to civilization.
Oh, sure, we all were.
And yeah, and then, you know, you do find out about Tesla and the truth and everything and the war between, you know, AC and DC currents. And you find out what kind of scumbag really Edison was.
Yeah, no, and Edison's a wife-beating child hater. It's just sort of like, oh, shit. It's like you find out that, like, Ulysses S. Grant was, like, a drunk, like a cross-eyed, bleary, blotto, blackout drunk. You know, it's the same kind of, like, the American Bummer. That should be, like, a series on PBS, like, American Bummers. It's just, like a 10-part series of Ken Burns Tonight, another,
David McCullough doing the narration, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You thought he was cool. Well, we're here to tell you the truth.
Yeah, and then Edison beat his wife and slapped a child. Tomorrow night on American Bummer, you know, Thomas Jefferson owned slaves. What are you talking about? Oh, yeah, Five Fists. Yeah, no, dude, Edison was a prick. Tesla was awesome. And Tesla, like, was like Bruce Wayne.
Yes.
Like he was, he looks like Ralph Fiennes.
Yeah,
have you ever seen photographs of him? Like, yes. Like, he looks like Ralph Fiennes. He's, like, incredibly handsome, and he's just this amazing weirdo.
Well, and also, again, much like Edison being considered this great god of invention, sometimes you get the feeling that Tesla was this failed inventor. But as you point out, no, he did have his moments of glory where things were good and people did recognize his genius.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the narrative is easier if it's Edison. If Tesla's a lunatic who died crazy with Scientific American or Popular Science, you know, paying his bills alone in New York, and Edison is the man who illuminated America, like, it's a simpler narrative.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So, like, well, actually, it's not clear. You know, Tesla, if it wasn't for Tesla, Marconi could not have invented could not have done his work on the radio.
Yep.
You know, and the Supreme Court agrees, but you never hear that. You know, you never hear, oh, right, well, Edison was a fucking son of a bitch that, like, killed elephants and started fires trying to convince people on a bet, you know, it's just, you know, he swindled Tesla out of billions of dollars. Billions. But, you know, that kind of looks shitty on the back of a cereal box, I guess.
Well, but you put these people, and I know you juxtaposed the woman and kind of brought her up to the 1890s just to have a woman maybe on the team.
Yeah. Well, she was who she was. She was there then, but she was more closer to Twain's age, or sort of between, She was like in her 50s at that point. But no, I mean, she's actually, you know, won the Nobel Peace Prize, actually suggested to Alfred Nobel, hey, why not a Peace Prize? Was very involved in the art. I mean, I didn't make her up. She's a real woman. We just made her, you know, young and kind of hot. because we're nothing if not crass marketers.
No, that's all right. It worked. And also, again, let's talk about Sam Clements, Mark Twain. I mean, it's a fascinating person that, you know, it's a shame that we only know Huck Finn, mostly from being banned from libraries, as opposed to really getting into, you know, what the guy was saying when he was really out in public. And you know, that rally that you have him appearing at where he's kind of yelling at, you know, the 1890s equivalent of hippies and free love and saying, get a life. What are you doing? You know, wrong. It's, you know, peace isn't easy. You have to have war to have peace. You have to understand what war is to appreciate peace.
Yeah. And, like, that's the stuff that we didn't make up. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Twain believed that everybody needed the A-bomb. Everybody, we didn't, you know what I mean? He didn't call it. We ran the essay in the beginning of the book. I mean, we didn't make that up. That was... He believed that after all the kind of work he did with the armistice movement. He was bankrupt. He bankrupted his family.
Yes.
And fled to Europe in financial exile, which is a beautiful idea that I think we should bring back. I got wrapped up in kind of the armistice movement, and this was his idea. He called it peace by compulsion, that everybody would be too terrified to start a war if everybody could end the world. And then Tesla, who was actually his friend, said, hey, I can end the world. And they had a plan. We didn't make it up either. Like, this was their, you know. I've said, like, before, you'd be, like, if we bet, like, what shit did I make up and what shit actually happened, like, obviously you've got me on the giant robots and monsters, but, like, other than that, it's kind of all there in one form or fashion.
Well, that's what makes it fun, and it's easy to dismiss.
Even the Yeti was discovered in 1899. The Yeti was first called the Yeti in 1899.
Wow.
Yeah, Migu was named Yeti in 1899.
That's cool. Well, that's what I was going to say. Like, I love League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. It's a fun story. But you're taking real people from history and some of the things they said and believed and things that actually happened and creating the same kind of story that Moore did with fictional characters.
Right, right. Only, yeah. Which is, and they did actually both take place in 1899. There's the expression, you know, thunder is fine, but it's lightning that gets the job done.
Sure.
There's some expression like that. You kind of hear lots of variations. Somebody said it to me one night, and I went Googling to find out who said it, and in connection discovered that Twain and Tesla were friends. And, like, right there, like what comic writer worth his salt doesn't think, oh, well, they fight crime? Like, the minute you hear, like, Mark Twain and Nikola Tesla were, like, buddies, like, best of friends, they totally have to team up and save the world. And then it turns out that they tried, so... You know, the story was just waiting there for us to ruin it.
Well, it was really cool. I also, you really do kind of get a kick out of not knowing where the story is going to take you. You like flying by the seat of your pants, don't you?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I always know, you know, the big stuff. I just don't know how the fuck I'm going to get there.
Okay.
It keeps me surprised. You know, like, I didn't know, well, there's a character in Independence, is a character that dies. That wasn't in the cards, but I needed people to do a thing, and that was the way to do it. You know,
okay.
It was as much a surprise to me writing it as it was to anybody reading it, if they were any ever surprised.
Okay.
I think what it is, like, I'm worried that if I know where I'm going too much, I'm not going to be able to not tip my hand and write predictably.
Okay.
So I can genuinely say I had no idea where the story was going. Most times, anyway.
Is there a plan for Casanova? I mean, there's, you know, there's... How many,
Casanova, the root of Casanova is like what if James Bond hooked up with Barbarella? You know what I mean?
Okay.
And so we've met Bond. and so, you know, Barbarella comes next. But no, there's a definite, like I said, I know the big plan. You know, I know the big points. I know where it's going to end. You know, pawn A might make it through and, you know, bishop B might not. But, you know, I look at the big stuff. Down, you know, I know where you know the first year and some change of War Journal is going to go. You know, it's just that I'm not necessarily, you know, have all the I's dotted.
Sure.
I'm actually about to finish writing the first volume of Casanova, which ends with Seven.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. Okay.
And that's our first kind of quote arc unquote. I mean, they're all sort of self-contained issues, but
yes.
You can tell it's all building towards something.
Sure.
But yeah, I'm actually like winding up part seven now, which is the end of volume one. And it's this very kind of like profound, don't know, kind of emotional time, like to sit down and write it. It's very weird how attached I've become to these kind of weird little people.
It's obviously gratifying that somebody like, you know, a magazine like Entertainment Weekly will discover Casanova and write about it. And
yeah.
It's, you know, it is in the comic book form, but it's also, you know, it's its own little animal. And I'm wondering, like, are you trying to find other markets, non-traditional comic markets, to kind of get the material, you know, into the hands of other people? Because this is one of those, you know, non-mainstream books that I think would, you know, find an interesting audience if they were aware of what was being told in the story.
Yeah, you talk about other media, you're not talking about, like, are you putting it into bookstores, correct?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. You know, we're...
Yeah, I'm working with the guy who's, you know, repping the property, as they say. And there's some very interesting spaces we're looking at getting into. That's another thing that, as they say.
Yes.
You know? So, yeah, it's a thing. But, I mean, it's a comic first and foremost, you know, and
sure.
Nearest and dearest to my heart. It's a comic, and I'm a comic writer, you know, and this is what I love to do. So, literally, if anything comes of it, it's gravy, you know, and it's awesome, and, you know, I'm not going to kick it out of bed for eating crackers. But at this point, it's just I'm trying to, as hard as I can, to make the best comic that I can write, you know.
How about the European market?
Boy, that'd be awesome. If you know somebody, have them give me a call.
Well, it's not, you know, it's.
It's going to get a lot easier when there's a collection.
Sure, sure.
And the demand has been kind of phenomenal so far.
Cool.
So, I mean, it's been great. You know, we had sort of your traditional drop between 1 and 2, and practically no drop between 2 and 3.
Good.
Which is kind of unheard of. Or is at least rare. So, you know, I think we're okay. I think we're finding an audience, you know, and the response has just been berserk. So, woohoo!
Nice going.
Thanks.
And looking forward to Punisher War Journal. And
can I talk about Ariel Olivetti for a second?
Absolutely, please.
Unbelievable, this guy. Unreal, and he's been around for a while, you know. And this book is you know, Marvel. Marvel just signed him. He's like one of the new young guns.
Okay.
You know.
Yes.
Even though he's been in comics for 15 years, but his work on this book is astonishing, and I've loved his stuff. He did a Justice League miniseries like back in the day that Grant Morrison and Mark Miller wrote.
Oh, okay.
Called like Paradise Lost. And do you remember Azuriel, the Hawkman, the Angel character?
Yes, yes.
He had a little spinoff series, and Ariel drew that. And like, I've loved this stuff since then, and it's like I'm writing a War Journal for him. You know, like I've been very lucky with working with him, and that I knew that he was our guy. And so, as like an Ariel fan, I'm sort of crafting the book to his strengths, I hope. And just the pages are just unbelievable. He's you know, going to be the next Simon Beisley. Easily, you know,
wow.
He's just going to be huge. This book is going to make him gigantic.
And let's talk about Gabriel Baez. Well, and I, you know, I'm such a writer's person that sometimes I do forget to acknowledge the cool artists that people hook up with. How did you find Gabriel for Casanova?
Well, I actually was talking to his brother Fabio, who I had seen, and was kind of talking to him about Casanova, and Gabriel and Fabio talked about it, and they kind of, between the two of them, decided that Gabriel would be better at it.
Okay.
And that Gabriel should, and then Gabriel, like, did some sketches. I was like, fuck yeah, okay, we're good.
Cool.
So I actually sort of, it was Fabio who suggested Gabriel, and God bless him, you know, every single day, thank my stars, because, well, you know, he's you know, Ba is huge. Ba is going to, he'll be a giant, and he's doing just unbelievably amazing work, and every issue is better than the last. And we all sort of, that's sort of an ongoing joke between the two of us. It's like when we finish one, we're like, okay, now that's my favorite issue. Like, that's the best one so far. That's your best work. And, like, you can tell, I think, in the back matter, like, I'm starting to show, like, just more and more of his pencils.
Yes.
It's just, he's astonishing. And I'm quite blessed. And we'll write for him, you know, until the day I die, if he lets me.
Will we see similar kind of text pieces in the back of Iron Fist or War Journal?
You know, I guess Marvel's kind of doing letter columns again, aren't they? Like a letter, like, because I know the Iron Fist actually got announced in like the Daredevil letter column.
That's a good point.
So I don't know. It just, I don't think in War Journal 1, but, you know, because War Journal 1 is, like, exercised. Like, War Journal 1 is, like, 32 pages, I think.
Oh, great.
With no ads.
Damn.
All killer, no filler.
Attaboy.
So, I don't know. We'll see. I haven't really talked about it yet or thought about it yet. That certainly wouldn't be that sort of, you know, hand-wringing, navel-gazing sort of pontificating about how awesome I am. That you see in Casanova. So.
Well, I'm curious about the art for Iron Fist. Who's drawing that for you guys?
David Aja. And this guy, holy crap, he's like, I sound like such a huckster, because I'm saying like the same like superlatives about every artist, like, and this artist is even better than the last, and you know, but wait, there's more. But Aja is phenomenal and an incredible find, and is a complete lunatic, and has been delightful to work with so far. But I think he's gonna, and that cover has gotten a tremendous response, you know.
Yeah.
I think he's going to be the next, you know, Alex Maleev or something.
Wow. How far along are you guys on Iron Fist?
We have, like, the first, like, year sort of. We're close to closing in on knowing, dotting the I's on that first year.
Okay.
You know, we've got the first. We have, like, 2-3 arcs, and we sort of, you know what I mean? It's getting more and more specific the more time we spend with it. As it kind of, you know what I mean? We're sort of exploring it, and you know, Civil War has changed everything, so there's sort of, you know, status quo isn't what it was, and mm-hmm. and so we're kind of, you know, and it was you know, it went from being a limited to an ongoing, you know,
like
response was so berserk, so it's like, oh well, shit, we can just, you know what I mean? So that changed stuff, and I think we have like a really fun first year planned out.
Cool.
And it's a fucking kung fu comic, so there's, like, a lot of kicking and punching.
Brubaker said that, you know, he thought you were bringing the action component into the story because he just felt he doesn't think he's that good at, I think, at doing action. I don't know. That's what he said.
Huh. Really?
Well, I'm going to have to go back and listen to my own tape. I'm not sure. But I thought that was the gist of what he was saying.
That's
so
interesting.
I think it's an interesting team-up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a kind of learning experience for me too. I mean, as much as like you're working on Punisher is a learning experience being with Axel, working with Ed has just been such a thing, you know, like kind of seeing his craft and how it works, and you know, how his, you know, he's between the time he spent at DC and now at Marvel. I mean, you know, it's been really educational and really kind of enjoyable to kind of it's like a teaching hospital, you know what I mean?
Sure.
So I'm a student, like, ghosted by a quite an able surgeon, so I'm not gonna screw up too bad.
Now getting back to Axel, is Axel the editor of the Max Punisher as well?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So are there, I mean, other than the obvious, you know, rules that, you know,
they're you know what I mean? Like, I don't know that it's ever been like that it's that there's too fine a point put on it, but they are separate animals.
Sure.
Like, I don't just mean, like, sort of content-wise, but I mean, like, you know, we spell Rikers with a Y, they spell it with an I, you know what I mean? Like,
okay.
You know what I mean? Like, it's a different planet, literally. we just want to be, you know, Garth is doing such a amazing book. It's just, and like, if you love crime comics, I mean, there's, it's just one of the best crime comics ever, period.
Sure.
And we're just, yeah, ours is so tonally different, and you know what I mean? Like at no point is Rhino going to come around the corner in Garth's book, or you're not going to have that Spider-Man cameo. So.
Right. Did you ever see yourself doing superhero stuff?
I never say never.
Okay.
I just never thought I was very good at it. You know, like when I would sit down and think about it, it all felt very sort of, it was a very weird way for me to think. So the kind of the cool thing about Punisher and Iron Fist is they're both very un-superhero superheroes.
Yes.
You know what I mean? They're both very, like, you know, I really pushed for Frank to put on the white boots and white gloves and, you know, the Ross Andrews suit in War Journal because it was a superhero comic.
Certainly.
You know, and I was like, oh, he's got to get dressed.
Right.
What's this casual t-shirt shit? No, I want to see dorky white gloves and the whole, like... You know, like, celebrate that. You know?
Absolutely.
So it's kind of a cool, like, there are a cool couple of books to cut your teeth on. But it's just sort of a different way of thinking, and you know, I would hope I'm maybe bringing some different spices to the stew, I guess. I
Absolutely.
But yeah, like I said, never say never, and it's just always a matter of. It's never one of the. I never have, and I never will. Like, just take a book just to do.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, I've always wanted to have something to say, some character to explore, some aspect of story to tell, or something. You know what I mean? So it's been very fun. It's been very gratifying. I feel like I've been very lucky. You know.
Are there any other oddball Marvel heroes that you'd like
Yeah. Oh fuck yeah! Are you kidding me? Oh my god. I would prefer, however, to keep my cards in my chest.
Fair enough.
Because, you know, who knows what editor is going to remember. Oh, yeah, I have that MODOK pitch in my drawer or whatever. But I was like a Marvel kid growing up, you know. So it's always, you know, between the Marvel and DC wars, I was, you know, I came up sort of on the Marvel side of the street.
Okay. Were you a Circle of Blood fan, Stephen Grant and...
Oh, fuck yeah, come on.
Mike Zack, thank you.
With Warren Simons, who's now the editor on Original After Four, Axel hands the reins over to Warren Simons. We were talking about those covers, there's a generation of comics kids who, like, when you think of the Punisher, you think of that, the white, you know what I mean, with the
yes.
targets spitting the blood out, you know.
You bet.
And then you think of the Klaus Janson shot with him, like, on the fire escape in the bazooka.
Yeah.
Like those are just like the Punisher. Like, that's like where you, it's like where everybody's like fixated on that icon. So.
That's.
But
cool.
Yeah, no, I love that series.
That's great. Well, other independent projects come up, or are you totally immersed in the Marvel world right now? Casanova, obviously.
But yeah, there's Casanova, which I'm gonna, you know, write till the wheels come off. And getting Five Fists kind of up and running and out the door was a big thing. There's a sort of anthology type of project that I've been developing with a guy named Kevin McCarthy, and that's sort of. I have like three scripts in the can for that. You know
is that
what I mean?
Night so, Radio?
So, say it again.
Is that Night Radio?
No. Night Radio was a Warren Ellis thing.
Oh, okay.
He was going to edit an anthology of like new writers, like in like 99 or 2000, I guess. Or 2000, 2001, something like that.
Okay.
And then like when he got sick and like his dad got sick and died and all that horrible happened to him, that sort of like was one of those projects that got sort of backburned until whenever.
I understand.
But this was good. The idea with this book, McCarthy and I, it would all take place at a hotel, and sort of each issue, like we would do half of an issue, and my half would be in one room, and his would be in the other, and it's like sort of a different, you know, people in each room every issue. you know what I mean? Sort of just like a story about a hotel.
That's cool.
But like I don't know where we're at with that. I don't know. You know, it's sort of it's weird with independent stuff. Like there's no, you know, there's a lot of hurry up and wait. There's a couple of projects that I've been writing on for a while. They're sort of sitting here. You know, I want to write a book about Abraham Lincoln that I'm starting to research.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I really want to write, the bicentennial is coming up. And with the midterms and elections, like, I want to write about, you know, a politician that was fucking worth a damn. I kind of want to write, like, a graphic novel about the 1864 re-election. Like, why can't you write a comic about that?
Wow.
but very serious, like very kind of like, you know, like, yes, yeah, so like I literally have a shelf full of Lincoln Civil War politics and Electoral College books that I'm kind of going through. So I have no idea. I'm kind of looking to figure out what slot four is going to be. I think I can handle about four books at once. So.
Okay. Now, staying with Lincoln, did you read that Doris Kearns Goodwin?
No, but it comes out in like paperback in like 2 weeks.
Okay.
So I've got, and that's about his political genius, I believe is the title, or the political genius of Abraham Lincoln, which would be incredibly appropriate. But yeah, I've kind of got some, I got plenty to keep me busy for now. But yeah, that's coming out. I'm very interested in reading.
Yeah, for people who don't know, I want to fill them in. It's almost the equivalent of if George Bush when elected, suddenly like turned to a bunch of Democrats and said, okay, I need you guys in my administration. Because that's basically what Lincoln did. He went to the opposing party and put a lot of the very people that were running against him as president. So, yeah, if Bush had turned to John Kerry and said, great, I need you as Secretary of State now.
Right.
You know,
right.
And it's pretty crazy when you think about that and put it in modern terms like that. But that's the kind of brilliant guy that Lincoln was.
Yeah, well, and that's why I want to write about 1864 specifically is the Civil War was still happening.
Yep.
And he ran for re-election. Like, that's profound. In a day, in an age when, like, our politicians are these sort of like inoffensive little maggots, both sort of oozing slowly towards the center and not trying to take credit for who they are or what they are. And you know what I mean? It's this sort of centrist, disgusting, despicable, embarrassing letdown of fucking human beings we call our leaders.
Yep.
Like, this was a man that literally lost half the country because of a principle that he believed in. And when he knew we could just, you know, like it was clear the war could end. Slavery would stay, but the war could end. And he could have made that choice all through the election, you know?
Yep.
He could have ended the war, but he refused to, like, that's a leader. My God. What a burden. What a human, like, can carry that weight. Abraham Lincoln. So,
yeah. Like,
I'm fascinated by that. And the history and the railroad and everything else is just, like, an amazing time. And you know, comics are uniquely suited. You know, you can incorporate all kinds of graphics and text and really kind of create a kind of multimedia experience, for lack of a better word, that really explores this in a way that you kind of can't in a book or a film or anything.
That sounds great, man. Well, it's certainly bigger than the Classic Illustrated.
Say it again?
I was going to say, it sounds more ambitious than the old Classic Illustrateds that I remember and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, or then again, I might just, you know, bitch out and rest of Spider-Man comics. I don't know.
Well, we look forward to it, man. Keep it up. And, good luck with Iron Fist and Punisher War Journal. I think they're going to be fun books with you taking care of things.
Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate it.
That's Matt Fraction, writing great books like Punisher War Journal and The Immortal Iron Fist for Marvel Comics. But don't forget also Casanova, the great spy series from Image. And do yourself a favor, look for the trades for great things like Rex Mantooth, Last of the Independents, Five Fists of Science, all wonderful books by Matt. Make sure you stop by the Word Balloon MySpace page, myspace.com/wordballoon. If you're an iTunes, Podcast Alley, Podcast Pickle, Odeo fan, they have reviews and they ask you to vote for your favorite podcasts. If you'd put Word Balloon on your vote column, we certainly would appreciate it. If you have any questions about the show or comments, I can be reached at john@wordballoon.com. So until next time, thanks a lot for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2006.